CliffCentral.com.
Ah, the Pretenders, Angel of the Morning. Well, he may not be the Angel of the Morning, he may be the Devil of the Morning to some, but Canton Pillay is with us for the Burning Platform this morning, which is brought to you by Nando's. Every single week we check in on all the current affairs stories that affect you and me and make our lives more interesting, sometimes a little more complicated, but certainly you can't hide your head in the sand like the famous ostrich does. You need to be able to pay attention to what's going on, make sense of it, and we try to do that with you on a Thursday morning. So big ups to Nando's for being brave enough to keep doing this with us, and to Canton for going through the news and helping make it a little more well understood. So we'll talk to Canton in a moment. We'll also be joined by Dr. Jonathan Witt a little bit later on. We're going to talk about his opinionated classical liberal stuff with a grand sense of humor. If you follow him on social media, you know what I mean. So it's always good to see him. Dr. Jonathan Witt joins us this morning on the Burning Platform. So welcome, gentlemen. It's nice to see you both. Another week that goes by where we don't have a woman on the Burning Platform. Some people brought this up and said that it's a major flaw in our process. I will endeavor.
Are they assuming my gender? What the hell is this?
I was just going to say the same thing.
Oh God, they're out of the starting blocks. They're on fire. Okay, guys. First things first. Jonathan, nice to see you. You listened to the Burning Platform last week with JJ, and you felt that there was a need for correction around some of the stats and some of the conventional wisdom that we're all spouting around COVID. You know, everyone's an expert on COVID now.
Yeah, Gareth, everyone's an expert. Unfortunately, all the information we get is sort of not the right information, certainly. My problem with what JJ said was, essentially, he was like, well, we need to test everyone, and we need to be running sort of these millions of tests, and that's the only way we solve this problem. That's a complete misunderstanding of what we should be doing here and how we should be managing the process. The problem is if you test someone, you actually have to then be able to do something with those people. There also is no sense of what the end goal here is. Right. If you could have a perfect scenario right now, you would infect every single person under the age of 40 without a comorbidity in the world, and this would be done in 14 days. That would be the end of that, and there would be no problem. So testing everyone ad nauseum doesn't help. You're seeing this in the United States, where they're doing a million tests a day. If they carry on like this, they're going to test the entire American population by the end of the year. And
for what? What good is it going to do anyone?
Exactly. And when we add up all the money spent on testing, going to be giant wastage. The other thing to say is that in a South African context, we don't have the capacity to do the testing we're doing. So we have delays on testing. And at a hospital level, what that's causing is a massive bottleneck because patients are coming in. Many hospitals separate patients as PUIs, persons under investigation, until proven otherwise. Now you sit in a ward where you are sitting with a whole bunch of other PUIs and up to 48 hours because the tests are taking that long to come back. And instead of the one person in this ward of 30 people who was a PUI, in the 48 hours they've been there, they've infected 10 others. And if we could get the result back in 45 minutes, which you actually can do with gene expert testing, then that wouldn't be an issue. So, no, testing is not the be-all and end-all unless you have track and trace. And with this virus, track and trace is virtually impossible. Even countries like South Korea have proven that becomes incredibly difficult.
Okay, but I want to ask you something else, because we see every day on the news, we see these bold headlines with numbers into the hundreds of thousands of people who have been infected, and they keep saying the United States has this unbelievable infection rate. Now, what does that mean? Shouldn't we be looking at the death rate? That's the scary number. That's what people should be paying attention to. Or am I wrong?
Yeah, I'm gonna say a couple of things. One is that we should not be looking at the number of infected, we should be looking at the who is infected. That is the number that we should have been looking at for months now, frankly. Mm-hmm. We, for example, know that the virus doesn't kill children. Let me caveat that and just say that, yes, there's a handful of children that have been killed worldwide, but overall it doesn't kill children. And so the numbers are largely irrelevant. It's the who. If you look at New York, for example, they sent ill elderly people back into nursing homes and ended up killing large groups of their nursing home population as a result. Hmm. So in terms of the numbers, yeah, that's a problem. The other side of the number problem is something I spoke about on the show before, which was this issue around serology, which is that we know that when you start testing the population in terms of who has actually had this virus and developed antibodies, and remember that number is not actually everyone who might have been exposed to the virus, but when you do test that, you get any number between 8 and 80 times the number of people that are showing positive tests, mm-hmm. which means that in a South African context, if we have just over 200,000 people now who are infected, and you take a conservative sort of serology population, that's probably about 20 times. So we actually don't have 200,000. We more likely have 4 million people who've had this virus.
What about people who are asymptomatic? We're hearing interesting results from tests being conducted all over the world and by various parties. So it's definitely not some agenda-driven thing. These are probably scientists who are trying to help figure out what's going on. They say that asymptomatic people very rarely pass on COVID-19 to other people.
Sorry, guys. Just say that last bit again.
They say it's very rare that asymptomatic people actually contagiously pass this disease on.
Yeah, I mean that's still being debated, to be honest.
Oh, okay.
Here's the thing. I think there are margins on everything here, and you know, we can talk about what they've now come out and said it's airborne. You know, we had this conversation on the show before.
Yeah.
So the margins are probably this, that asymptomatic people don't generally spread the virus, but there are some who are so-called asymptomatic and do manage to spread the virus, because asymptomatic is a very relative term with a virus that causes so many different kinds of symptoms that you might feel perfectly fine, but you're actually not. You're symptomatic. You just don't notice it, or you're one of those people who always gets a scratchy throat in winter and you just walk through it, if you know what I mean.
But the other complicated thing about this is that, you know, we have so many people wading in on the discussion with new information that comes out from, you know, research that's being conducted, or just hearsay, frankly, by lots of people. We hear about a second wave in some countries, which I need to talk to you about. And then also there is a panic setting in South Africa, and it's largely driven by the politicians, which always makes me suspicious. But, you know, Gauteng is about to see a real outbreak, and it's going to be severe, and it's going to be damning, and this is the end. Now, what do you make of that stuff? Please give me some sensible, scientific, medical advice around whether or not we need to be panicking, because I have very very reasonable, very sensible people telling me, oh Jesus, now the deaths are starting, get ready, it's coming.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's somewhat true, in the sense that Gauteng is going to peak over the next 2 to 3 weeks, and so what we saw in Cape Town, where Cape Town was hitting 40, I think at one point even 50 deaths a day, that's going to happen in Johannesburg at whatever our peak is. That seems to change per region and per country, for reasons we don't fully understand. So, but our peak is not going to be anywhere near other places in the world. So you know, we're currently doing near 100 deaths a day countrywide. As Cape Town drops, Joburg will maintain probably somewhere in the ballpark. But bearing in mind that New York at one point was having 1,200 to 1,600 deaths a day, the UK was having 700-800 deaths a day. We're not going to reach those numbers. It's highly unlikely that we will get there. And once we reach that peak, and you see the sort of, so the thing to follow is the death numbers day on day. And when they stop rising, and then they will remain flat for a period of time, and then what will happen is they will start to drop. The virus does kill people. That's goes without saying. Usually a specific group of the population. And no, there is no reason to panic. In some sense, there's not much you can do. And in other senses, for those who are at risk, there are certain precautions we should be trying to take, as we've known.
Canthan, I heard a politician on the news last night, I think he's the MEC for Health in Gauteng, saying they've dug, they're going to need to dig 1 million graves.
You know, I sent a note out to my friend of mine saying that, you know, we really have some idiot journalists in the country who just go ahead and happily report such stuff. If you do the maths on this, if you have 1,000 deaths a day, then you're going to have 3 years before we are going to fill 1 million graves. So we need 3 years of 1,000 deaths a day to end up filling 1 million graves. Now, the thing for me, how much is it costing to dig those graves? So let's work on a conservative estimate of 1,000 rand a grave. So you want to dig 1 million graves at 1,000 rand a piece, and hey, presto, there's 1 billion that's gone into the pocket of some tenderpreneur who's going to be digging holes in the ground. And then at the end of the pandemic, we'll end up filling them up again. Then let's.
I mean,
basic maths.
I'm sorry, it's so sensational. And for this to be broadcast and for this to be spread around as if it's some kind of gospel, this is going to make people who are, you know, for good reasons sometimes, cautious people, frightened people, paranoid people. It's going to make them even worse.
The problem is we don't have journalists who can actually calculate things on a fly and actually turn around and say, actually, listen, the numbers that you're giving make absolutely no sense whatsoever. Where did you come up with this figure of 1 million from?
Sorry, you know, Kevin, we don't have journalists who can calculate anything. These are people who did BAs, who basically flunked out of maths in high school, or at best did standard grade. And frankly speaking, this is a statistical situation going on here. And unless you have a very good understanding of stats, you have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, but Jonathan, it doesn't need to be a very good understanding of stats. You need a very minimal understanding of stats. Now, every time someone turns around and tells me, oh, my God, look at the United States. They're a basket case. And look, you know, people are drying and it's all Trump's fault. And I turn around and I tell them, do you know that the United States is testing 600,000 people per day? Now, just let that sink in. That's that favorite woke expression. Let that sink in.
It's closer to 1 million.
Well, the tests that they're reporting are about 600,000 a day.
That's unbelievable. If we were doing that, we'd be finished in a couple of weeks.
Well, just think about the logistics of actually rolling out those tests on a daily basis. More than 500,000 people, you're putting them through the process of testing them and getting results. And it's no surprise that the United States has figures.
So I have, again, smart friends who say to me, oh, but look, Sweden is now a shitstorm. And it's an example, a cautionary tale of how lockdowns were absolutely essential. Sweden is a disaster. Explain that to me. And then they say, the US has got the highest infection rate of any country in the world. Tell me why. If they're so clever.
Well, Sweden did what we're all going to end up doing for the most part. You know, as I say, we don't fully understand why in certain regions it's worse than others. For example, New York and Chicago don't make any sense. But Sweden has virtually no deaths a day. Sweden no longer has an epidemic by any definition of that classification. Coronavirus is no longer a problem there. You asked about second wave, what I call second wavism. Mm-hmm. Second wavism is not going to happen in most places. The places that are going to get second waves are places like Australia. New Zealand's going to probably have a very nasty second wave. And they're going to have third and fourth waves, because what they keep doing in places like that is they have the systems to try and sort of shut it down and track and trace the best they can. So as they play catch up with that system and eventually get on top of it, because it's an island and no one can come in or out, they will clamp down on the virus. But there's only two ways through this virus. And one is herd immunity through enough people getting it. And the other is vaccination, which is another type of herd immunity. That's the only way you're getting through this virus. Running away, hiding away is not going to change that. The infection rate in the United States makes no difference whatsoever, because the death rate is really what matters. At the end of the day, you want a high infection rate. Ultimately, that's your ultimate goal. Your ultimate goal is to get the highest possible infection rate you can in the healthiest population you can. And if that happens, you end up getting herd immunity to this virus with minimal number of deaths.
All right, let's talk about the politics for a second, Canton. Why does it seem that the media, I mean, the media part's easy to explain because they want ratings. So they want people to be afraid, and then people watch the news and pay attention to the news. So that I understand, and they click, you know. But why is it so many politicians want to see more deaths? They almost make it patently obvious that they're hoping for more people to die.
Well, the basic premise around wanting to see higher numbers of deaths is because it reinforces their policy position and allows them to then justify the draconian measures that they put in place that have basically shut down our entire economy, led to unprecedented, I'm using that word very deliberately, unprecedented levels of malnutrition among our school kids.
Jonathan, I'm very worried about something that another doctor told me about. Cancer patients at the moment cannot get the kind of treatment that they might have been able to get pre-COVID because a lot of hospitals have dedicated themselves almost entirely to COVID, or they've shut down because there have been infections inside the hospitals and people have been paranoid about passing on COVID to, you know, doctors, nurses, and patients who are already in hospital. So we've made special provisions and we've tried to get ready for an epidemic level of hospital attendees, people who need treatment for COVID. Cancer patients and other people who are suffering from other kinds of diseases who would normally be able to get treatment for these in state and private hospitals are not able to access this at the levels that they were before. Surely this is going to lead to many more unnecessary deaths, and there are probably people who are in desperate situations right now.
Yeah, this is no doubt. There's evidence to show this already. This isn't a guess. We don't have South African evidence to show this, but New York has already shown their cardiac death rate has increased. So people who should have ended up in a cath lab getting stents, cardiac stents, have ended up dying. That's already happened in France. They've shown that during their lockdown, their pre-hospital cardiac arrest, the numbers doubled, which obviously shouldn't have happened, shouldn't make sense. But if you think about the fact that people were locked down at home and not calling ambulances or not able to present to hospital earlier and then waited till the last minute when they were essentially in collapse, that's what's happened there. In the South African context, this is going to be catastrophic. There's already modeling that's taken place which says we're going to lose 80,000 HIV patients, which we wouldn't have otherwise lost as a result of lockdown. Because those people were not able to properly access the health services and get medication, bearing in mind that we're probably...
And interestingly, Jonathan, on that particular point, one of the justifications that our government used was that HIV positive people would be more vulnerable to the virus.
Which hasn't really been shown as a major issue. If you are already in a poor state as an HIV patient, but then you're a sitting duck for most things. There's no doubt that we're going to see that in terms of cancer patients. I'm pretty sure. I don't have data for this, but I'm pretty sure there are patients who are being delayed in terms of their cancer treatments on radiotherapy, chemotherapy. But the other thing to say is that if you go to cancer, who keeps the best the organization, who keeps the best stats on this, we have been missing roughly 9,000 diagnoses per month of cancer. Because remember, you have to diagnose cancer first. So you've usually got to go and get a biopsy of something. And a biopsy often involves a surgery. And we haven't had, you know, standard straightforward elective surgeries for months. So now what's happening, certainly not at the same scale as we were before. And so what's happening is up to 9,000-10,000 people a month are not getting their cancer diagnosed. And what does that mean? Well, it means maybe you get diagnosed in November, December, January, instead of being diagnosed in April, May, June. And so you've got cancer's got an extra 6 months to be in your body. And if it's an aggressive cancer, that could be the difference between life and death.
Jesus, that's very scary. You've been outspoken about a lot of things that we'll get to in a second. I know you called Bulelani Nkolani, the guy who stripped naked and got arrested in this very public display. We spoke about him yesterday on the show. You said he's like our own Jussie Smollett, which I thought was an interesting comparison.
Juicy Smollett, please get it right.
Juicy Smollett. But it's it's just, Canton, there's a lot going on in the world at the moment, and obviously some of it is made up and some of it is for show. It's what we've now learned a word for this is performative, right? But there are real problems in the world, and there are real problems in South Africa. There are real problems in America. You mentioned malnutrition earlier. These levels, these unprecedented levels of malnutrition, have we started to calculate the cost of the lockdown, not just in respect to the medical situations that Jonathan mentions now, but in terms of all the other stuff? Because now we're three and a half months in, 100 days. I mean, what is the picture looking like from the point of devastation of the economy?
Actually, let me just back off on that. I'll return to that in a second. One of the issues that we have in terms of how we actually look at the way in which our economy performs is that so much of it actually falls beneath the radar. Mm. If you consider that our rural economy, our township economies, our mass transportation economy, all are outside of the tax net. And any estimates that we might make in terms of how much money is actually flowing through those ecosystems is actually unknown to us. So when you remove the ability of people who work within those ecosystems to actually earn a living, and if you consider a single minibus taxi driver who we'll say on average is generating, let's say, about 2,000 Rand a day in revenue, mm-hmm. and calculate, 60,000 Rand a month based on a single taxi driver, then multiply that by the number of minibus taxis that we have around the country, and you have a rough estimate at the point at which those taxis stop running for a period of 1 month, how much money fails to move through the economy. There just isn't enough data that we can make use of in order to calculate this. Now, interestingly, the people who are in a position to give us very accurate data on this type of stuff are the alcohol companies and it's the cigarette companies, mm-hmm. because they actually know where their product moves to, what the demand is. And from that, we can actually end up extrapolating just how much money is moving through the informal sector. So your shebeens, for example, which are outside of the tax net, but trust me, breweries has a fridge in every single one of those places and are able to calculate just how much alcohol is going in there. And as a result of that, we can then guess how much money is actually being spent in those spaces. Now, we do not have the intellectual capacity in our current government to actually recognize the importance of doing track and trace on those things, which then give us a sense of exactly what's happening with the economy. So the only thing that they see happening is what moves through the formal sector. And the only thing that they see happening is a reduction in the amount of money that now starts flowing into Tito Mboweni's budget. And immediately it shifts their mindset so that they start thinking in terms of, well, what would Xi Jinping be doing in this situation? And that's exactly the scenario that we have right now.
Well, let's talk about that, because we got an email for The Burning Platform this week from Richard. He said, "Hi, guys. I was hoping The Burning Platform could touch on the growing anti-China sentiment around the world, especially with respect to Hong Kong, the skirmish with India, and disputes in Eastern Russia, TikTok banning, etc. There's a lot happening, so it would be nice to hear from your guests, some varying opinions. Love the show, Richard." Okay, Richard, such an interesting question. And we will come back to South Africa in a moment. But this is really, I thought, timeous. You mentioned Xi Jinping. So go on, Canton. I mean, do you want to talk first of all about that skirmish with India, which largely went unnoticed in the media? Hong Kong is mostly being ignored in the mainstream. I mean, people are obsessed with COVID, obviously, and Donald Trump. But these are all very important things.
Yeah, the skirmish with India is an interesting thing. We could actually devote an entire show to what that's all about. But essentially, the skirmish with India is all about a portion of the Indian border that passes through disputed territory. And this is the entire Jammu and Kashmir region. Now, Kashmir, as most of us are aware, is disputed territory because it's claimed by both India and Pakistan. It's divided into two chunks. One is which the Indians refer to as Pakistan occupied Kashmir, or POC for short. And then there's Jammu and Kashmir, which is a state of India. But it's also where the Chinese border passes very close to both countries. And effectively, what the Chinese have been trying to do is to extend their Belt and Road Initiative across to Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And that means the building of a road through the disputed territory. And India's point is, well, actually, if you are building a road through disputed territory, which we are claiming, you are effectively declaring war against us. And so there's this massive face-off that has been happening out there. The interesting thing for me, though, is that, yes, you had the skirmish, and yes, you had deaths on both sides, but those deaths did not come from shooting.
Oh?
So, yeah. So, in other words,
yeah, horrible
there was hand-to-hand combat that took place. And what is promising for me about that, guys, what is promising, okay, is that it's actually showing restraint on the part of both sides.
Okay.
Because, you know, the easiest thing as a soldier, you train to pick up your gun and to shoot and to wipe out the other guys.
Mm-hmm. They did stab each other, though, Captain.
They did stab each other, absolutely, Jonathan. But the fact of the matter is that you have these two nuclear powers, representing what, about a third of the world's population in total.
Not going to maximum force immediately.
Not going to maximum force. So, so I think at that level, it's very clear that on both sides, this is a war that they don't want.
Yeah.
And it's a very high stakes game.
And what about Hong Kong? Because China has really just throttled any ideas of independence, of freedom and liberty in Hong Kong. People in Hong Kong are now waving the U.S. flag, which you Americans are not waving because they take for granted the rights that they have in America. But Hong Kong is essentially now being subsumed into mainland China and will probably lose its independence.
The Hong Kong scenario is kind of fascinating. Because you see, what's been interesting is that for a number of years, right up until the time that the markets with mainland China have been opened up, the way in which the mainland used to breathe was effectively through Hong Kong.
Right.
Because that's the conduit to trade with the rest of the world. And frankly, the only reason why Hong Kong is as prosperous as it is because of the fact that the Western world gives undue latitude to Hong Kong that they would never give to the mainland. And that latitude includes things like free movement of currency, as a very specific example. It allows the Hong Kong government to effectively peg the Hong Kong dollar to the US dollar, you know, which results in instability. So, as I said, free transfer of money, free exchange of information, all of those things. When you have a scenario now where effectively the rest of the world is looking to China and saying, we are actually going to be clamping down on you guys, because for the longest time now, we've been exporting our jobs in your direction, and you've been prospering at the expense of jobs back in our own countries, and we're now going to be pulling back on that. And at the same time, you have mainland China being terrified about what's going to happen if people in the mainland get a sense of what's happening in Hong Kong, and then try to replicate that behavior. So it's not about Hong Kong. It is all about the fact that Taiwan has been very clear that they are now turning around and saying, you know, whatever rapprochement we have had in the past, we are actually scaling back from, because this is do or die for us. Hmm. We are going to have to close ranks and actually make out a case with the rest of the world for Taiwan to be an independent country once again. In other words, to drive a truck through the One China policy. You have Hong Kong wanting to do the same thing. You already have an established Chinese-led state, which is Singapore, which has shown the world how embracing the path of essentially a capitalist economy leads to untold prosperity for all of its citizens. And that is the reason why Xi Jinping has to be as hard-assed as he's being right now in Hong Kong. Look, guys, what we should be very clear about in terms of Hong Kong. Hong Kong was always on a clock. And the clock was basically set for 50 years from 1997. What's really happened right now is that Xi Jinping is saying, actually, you know, we're driving a truck through this right now, and we are going to now start imposing things that are going to crack down on any potential that these guys are going to be an example for the rest
This is an example of the hubris of liberalism, because what has happened here is that they thought in 1997, well, we'll put a clock on this of 50 years. Mm-hmm. China is up and coming from an economic perspective, and they've already dropped some of their communist bullshit. And what will happen is in 50 years' time, China will be a very different place. It'll be a liberal homestead, and it'll have moved far more to resemble what the West looks like than what they look like in terms of their communist shithole in the 1970s, 60s and 70s. And that hasn't happened. All China's done is gone, thank you, we'll take your money, and we'll subjugate our slaves, and we'll build your iPhones. And by the way, that nice-looking little outpost you built for us, we'll take that too. And we're seeing the same thing happen in America, by the way, which is this idea that the existence of freedom and liberty will result in freedom and liberty, instead of the actual push for freedom and liberty. And unfortunately, Hong Kong is going to fall completely, in my opinion, as what it has already as a free entity. But it's a really poor example of what can happen anywhere else in the world, especially with China basically trying to become a dominant, the dominant player, not a dominant player in the world, and essentially hell bent on global domination. They're just far more patient than Hitler.
Jesus. But there could be light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, we could get TikTok removed from most of the world except China. That would be good. The US would ban TikTok. I'd love that.
Yeah, there's an interesting expression there that Jonathan has about the hubris of liberalism. And I do tend to agree with it. You see, one of the issues for me, Jonathan, in terms of Hong Kong, is that effectively from the UK's point of view, there was a moral imperative to hand Hong Kong back, because essentially Hong Kong was taken on a 1990 lease, and there was an obligation on the part of the United Kingdom to actually live up to that promise. And I'm one of these people who actually firmly believes that when you have countries that draw up treaties or draw up agreements, that one should actually honor them, because the only way that we end up with a scenario where people are able to trust any sort of integrity in terms of global leadership is when people actually abide by those regulations. So when we have treaties, we fundamentally need to have very specific structures in terms of how those treaties get broken. Now, by my point of view, in terms of what Xi Jinping is doing right now, he has broken the terms of the agreement with the United Kingdom. The question then becomes, how does one actually resolve it? Because you can't actually now have...
The UK is not going to declare war on China over this.
No, they can't. And understand that the reason why the UK had to seriously pull out in the first place was in 1984, when Deng Xiaoping met with Margaret Thatcher, and he just told her the sentence, "I can put 1 million troops into Hong Kong in an hour. What can you do?" And yeah, that's the point at which Thatcher said that storm.
You know, Kenton, my father used to say there's no such thing as a fair fight. When you get into a fight, there are no rules. And the problem here is that what's happened is the West has decided they're going to follow the rules. And as you said, they had to give it back because it was the morally right thing to do. But the party on the other side is not willing to follow rules. And in many ways, Britain could make this very painful for China. For example, Britain could deploy half their naval fleet into the South China Sea. And they could basically stop the advance that's happening there, which is a forward operating base, which is being set up by China for when they attack the United States, Australia, and Japan. So frankly, the problem is that everyone else is trying to play fair by this sort of rule book, while the guys on the other side don't have a rule book.
Yeah.
And they're willing to poke you in the eye and kick you in the nuts. And they're not just going to, fists above the belt. That's not how China works. And until everyone else learns
Queensbury rules.
Yeah, until everyone learns that lesson, they're going to keep getting sort of hit to the ground.
Yeah, Jonathan, agree 100% with the stuff that you're saying. But again, if you look in terms of our options right now, it is practically impossible for Boris Johnson to suddenly be ending up deploying a naval force.
I'm not sure Boris Johnson can do anything right now. What a disappointment.
Well, I think if you consider the forces that, and it's essentially the anti-Brexit forces who have been aligned against him, I'm surprised that the guy has been doing as well as he has been doing, all things considered. Look, I think take the following view, all right? Firstly, the best defense right now that we have against China's plans for world domination is Donald Trump. Let's be very clear about it. Let's be very clear about this. Whatever you may think about Donald Trump, he has actually nailed it in terms of the way in which China has been engaging with the rest of the world and the steps that he's taken in terms of the tariffs and in terms of moving American jobs back home. That's exactly what needs to be happening. Now, also take this view that if you suddenly now have a swing post-COVID where people start turning around and saying, actually, we are going to accede to Taiwan's desire to be recognized as an independent state. And I think that is actually starting to be a groundswell of opinion now, especially if you look in terms of the way in which each of these territories handle their responses to COVID.
Yeah.
Taiwan was one of the first places that was telling the World Health Organization, guys, you're talking rubbish. Here's what our data is showing us. Here are the steps that we have actually taken. And what did mainland China do? They said, no, you're not allowed to listen to Taiwan because they're part of China. Mm-hmm. And they need to report through us. And people are now calling bullshit based on that. So consider a scenario over the post-COVID period where you have the swing in terms of people saying, all right, we're going to move stuff away from China. Don't underestimate the significance of India saying we are shutting down all of these software packages that are coming from China.
Yeah, and don't underestimate the fact that the Chinese rural population are slowly becoming more and more wise to the fact that their government are not necessarily doing things that are good for them. We must also remember what Canton said just now about how Hong Kong is a cautionary tale for the rest of China. And there may be a huge amount, especially as growth slows down, because growth is the only thing, as our government have unfortunately never learnt, growth is the only thing that pacifies a population, even when there are inequalities, because people have the opportunity to improve their lives. And in China, with the economy slowing down the way that it is, and certainly not being able to reach the heights of prosperity in terms of growth that they've experienced over the last 10 years, that population is going to become a lot more fractious.
Yeah.
Well, we've already seen what they've been doing in terms of the Uyghur Muslims around.
Well, concentration camps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were going to say, Jonathan?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that's essentially correct. I take quite a harsh stance on China. I want to see them ground into the dust. I want to see manufacturing move out of their wholesale. I want to see pretty much unwritten sanctions against any countries that China supports, places where they've done Belt and Road initiatives and have heavy influences with those governments. I want to see America moving into, and Europe for that matter, moving into Africa hard. China needs to learn a lesson, and every country in the world needs to learn a lesson that if you are illiberal, you will not gain the access that you wish to get. You will not build the wealth that you wish to get. We all need to start taking a little bit of what we like to live and what we like to believe, and we need to start enforcing it around the world as populations and as nations. Unfortunately, what we're seeing at the moment is an internal challenge to this in the United States, in Great Britain, in Europe, even in South Africa to a large extent. Well, we've had it for a long time. We have an illiberal government. The reality is there needs to be a fight back. Otherwise, liberalism is going to die. And in 100 years' time, this world is going to look way more like China than it will the United States.
All right. So let's just bring it back home for a second, because there are quite a few things that we need to just touch on. There are people who are talking about South Africa having an online voting system by 2021. Do you think that's likely, unlikely? And just, I mean, try not to be as cynical as we usually would. Is there any possibility that this may be implemented in some way?
Yes. If we went to the private sector, we undoubtedly have the technology and the ability to do this in South Africa, probably better than any other country in the world. If I just think about our banking system and the platforms of our banking system and our sort of electronic banking, which is world class and world leading, there's no doubt we could do this. However, the government will give it to the IEC, and the IEC will get some morons who will get a tender to try and do this, and it will be an utter dog show. Over and above that, I think also the other problem you're going to confront, which it will be that this kind of thing would be a smart phone or a smart platform, and not everyone in this country has access to that. A lot of people do, but not everyone. And voting has to be absolutely accessible to everyone. So, I imagine there'd be a lot of debate around that. But I do think we could do it, but not our government, the private sector.
Canton, do you have any comments on that?
No, Jonathan has very effectively summed it up. Look, what I will say is that, I do have some experience in this technology space. And Jonathan, one actually doesn't need access to a smartphone in order to implement this. You need access to a phone. And because USSD technology has the ability to do geolocation and we already have Rika in place that is assigned cell phones to particular individuals, which can then be checked, just matched up against the voting register, and we take it from there. And it's very possible to actually audit that. But yeah, I actually completely agree with you. This can never work under the Ramaphosa government. These guys were not able to put in place any of the track and trace systems that were necessary for all of the COVID monitoring. Right now, every company around the country that has opened up is keeping registers of people who are coming into work, and every day they have to do things like temperature checks. They have to fill out registers. None of that is getting fed back electronically to any data processing center where things are actually going to help. I pointed out that when I drove up from Plett back to Joburg on the 1st of May, that I went through a number of roadblocks, and every single one of them, they were writing down by hand the number of people that were coming through, where they were heading to. Are those being taken and then being fed into a database somewhere where it can be processed? Absolutely not.
And thank goodness, we don't need this government to have more information on us.
Yeah,
but I agree with you. Why collect information if you're not doing anything with it?
Yeah,
yes, because idea creates jobs.
But guys, there's so much of this performative stuff going on. I mean, I'm trying to be a good citizen and to be respectful of people who are genuinely afraid of COVID, for example. So I, wear a mask and I try not to be obstreperous about these things. If someone wants me to fill in a form and they point that stupid temperature thing at my head, which does, I think, nothing, Jonathan, am I wrong?
It's a very useful tool for a very short period of time, and all the rest of the time it's very useless. So in other words, if you're going to get COVID, you're going to get a fever for a very narrow window, if you get fever, because only about 60 to 70% of patients will get a fever who develop symptoms.
You get my point. It's like we're going through, it's almost like we're all play acting. Like,
no, we are.
Let's all pretend we're taking this terribly seriously.
And now there's more play acting happening, because now they're saying, well, maybe airborne transmission is a thing. Which obviously it's a thing, but it's never been a major source of spread, and they're trying to push it as a major source now, and I don't buy that. But even if they twist on this and they turn around and go airborne transmission, they're doing it based on 5 micron particles. And guess what? All the masks you're wearing don't protect you against 5 micron particles.
Well, someone said to me that if you can smell a fart through jeans, then you can definitely catch COVID through a mask.
Yeah, well, listen, we've known this. That's true. I mean, the reality is that the masks have never been 100%. The only mask that's going to be close to 99% is an N95, supposedly 95%. But against COVID, it'll be around 99. The realities are that the masks were there as sort of a try and slow the spreads type of idea. And that was the sense behind it. I was perfectly fine with masks if the trade for having some freedom and liberty to be able to go to the shops or sit in a restaurant or get on with my bloody life was wearing a mask, then I was happy to wear a mask.
Yeah.
But this sort of notion that we're going to wear masks for the rest of our existence on Earth is absolutely insane.
All right. I know you're both chomping at the bit to talk about America. So let's go over there for a second, because Joe Biden has vowed, if he is elected president, and his numbers are looking very good at the moment. Not that that's anything, because we know Hillary Clinton's numbers looked fantastic in November of 2016, and she didn't win the election. But we do know that Donald Trump's trailing in the polls in almost every measure at the moment. And Joe Biden says once he's president, he's going to reverse the decision on the WHO. He's going to sign the Paris Climate Accords. He's going to do what Trump did to all Obama's decisions.
Basement Biden. Because he's been hiding in his basement for, 5 months now?
Yeah.
He came out once and didn't know how to put a mask loop over his ear. I mean, but dementia will do that to you. The thing is that, sure, I fully believe him. He will sign the Paris Accords. It's an easy win. He will reverse the WHO decision and probably some sort of UN decision, because I can't imagine Trump won't, especially if Trump loses, by the way. I imagine there'll be a lot that happens in that last 2 months. The problem with ruling from the executive in the United States is that it's never permanent. And Barack Obama was the worst example of this. No other president has ruled from the executive as Barack Obama did, with executive orders and his power from there. And the issue with that is anyone can come and reverse it, because the system was never designed to be ruled from that office. That office is for execution, not for legislation. In terms of the polling, nationwide polling means nothing. It has no real effect. That's like trying to take a popular vote in the United States. You've got to look at the swing states. You've got to look at what's happening in places like Wisconsin, Michigan, Florida, those places that are really going to affect the election. There's been a sort of multi-pronged attack against Donald Trump, which has been going on for several months now. So they dropped impeachment very quickly to move on to COVID. Mm-hmm. And COVID is the baseline. So whenever they run out of a story, they go back to COVID. But in between COVID, we've had Black Lives Matter, and that's because, of course, Donald Trump doesn't care about black people, and he's a white supremacist, and he supports white supremacists. And even though Black Lives Matter existed in 2015 when Barack Obama was president, it's definitely worse now because Donald Trump is president. And so we had that, and then we had riots. But as usual with all these sort of lefty ideas, is they end up eating themselves, because what's happening now is you're very much seeing statements coming from Donald Trump's press secretary, which is basically pushing him as a law and order president. And Americans like law and order, and they like law and order presidents, and they vote for law and order presidents. That's really what's going on. And you keep seeing it. The other thing they've pivoted back to is Russia, by the way. They're convinced that Russia is going to influence their election again, which is hilarious. That Donald Trump's going to allow them, because, of course, he's in bed with the Russians, even though it was actually the Democrats in bed with the Russians, because the entire Steele dossier came from the Russians and was paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign.
Yeah, but let's, I think, Gareth, more to the point, apropos of your question, the far more interesting thing for me is not what happens in terms of the presidential elections, but what really is happening in terms of the Senate and in terms of what's happening in Congress. Mm. And we've already seen in the primaries a swing away from establishment Democrats in favor of people who are fans of the squad. Yeah. So, for example, we have in New York someone who is a 30-year veteran of Congress being displaced by an up-and-coming squad member as the candidate. Now, here's what happens as a result of this, that you will have a swing that takes place in the primaries towards this particular candidate, but then it does mean that moderate Democrats are less likely to go and vote for a radical squad supporting candidate, and they are more likely to stay away from the polls. In other words, you are then likely to have a scenario where those seats actually swing in favor of the Republicans. And that's something that no one's actually applying their mind to now. And it's going to be an interesting scenario come the election.
This is the go woke, go broke argument.
Yeah, well, to some extent. I suppose you could extrapolate the go woke.
No, I mean, it's always true that when one of the candidates who's elected is more radical or more reactionary, it pushes those moderate voters to the other side, even though it's distasteful to them. They would prefer
someone
who is a civilized person rather than a screaming maniac.
Yes, absolutely correct.
Although there is an interesting thing happening on the other side. I mean, Camden, I tend to agree with you, and you're referring to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or occasional cortex, as Gad Saad calls her. But you know, she got 17,000 votes, I think it was, to end up in Congress. That's actually how many votes she won, which is essentially nothing. And it's hilarious how much influence she has over the Democratic Party, given how little support she actually has in any community. But on the other side, what's happening is quite interesting. The Republican base, which is very supportive of Donald Trump, is revolting against their own party. If you listen to Tucker Carlson, you hear a lot of echoes of this, which is that the feeling is that Republicans never stand up and do what's right. And they always say, well, when we're in power, we'll fix things. And then when they were in power and they held the Senate, the Congress and the presidency all at once, they did absolutely nothing with it. They didn't even reverse Obamacare.
And there are a lot of Republicans who are now waiting in the wings in case Trump loses, so they can say, well, we weren't part of that.
Yeah, well, that's happening to one aspect. And there's a lot of voters who are disillusioned with sort of these Republicans who've been no different to the Democrats, frankly, collecting a paycheck in Washington for 20 or 30 years. So I think it's going to be very interesting. I agree with you. Congress and Senate will be interesting. And look, the American system is very robust. And the fact is that it doesn't really matter who's president. It does matter in terms of the executive orders that we spoke about earlier. But essentially, where America moves is very dependent on having those three parts of government lined up. And because it's so partisan at this moment, you don't get a lot of agreements in the House between the Republicans and Democrats, and so very little legislation happens, which is also part of a reason why America is flying, because the government is not interfering in things.
Yeah, well, government's stuck, and that's usually a good thing for the people.
Yeah.
There's no over-regulation.
I think all of us can agree that, you know, in spite of all of the criticisms that people around the world have about the United States, I really think that the United States is the single biggest example of the best of humanity, really. Because
you're going to be setting fire to people now. You're insane.
No, absolutely. It's only the United States that could actually allow a scenario where someone like Elon Musk is allowed to do the kind of stuff that he does. There's nowhere else in the world that he could have gone in and actually pulled off that kind of stuff.
Or where Kanye West can say he's running for president.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, Canton, there's no disagreement here. I think part of the problem is obviously that everything that happens in the United States gets amplified, especially the bad stuff. And that's that obviously then resonates all around the world and sets a certain tone. The other thing is when you say something positive about any country, people immediately try to bring up the negatives. And I think obviously there's no such thing as perfection. But America gets certainly the closest because they essentially have the most liberal constitution in the world in protecting everyone's rights, not in protecting a single group's rights. There are many liberal constitutions which aim to protect certain individuals, certain groups' rights. But America protects everyone equally, and you can be a hateful bigot, essentially, and your rights are protected in the United States. And that actually is important.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid we're out of time. This has been very full and very satisfying. I've enjoyed hearing from both of you. Jonathan, thanks for clearing up a lot of the bullshit around COVID. Canton, we will check in again next week.
Awesome, guys.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having
me. This is The Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's on cliffcentral.com. Pass it around to your friends. Try and get them to engage with the truth occasionally, because the mainstream media will do the opposite to you and will confound you. It'll confuse you. It'll make you miserable. It'll make you paranoid. And before you know it, you'll be going crazy. I mean, my father sits in front of the TV and he shouts at it for at least 3 hours every fucking day. And it drives me mad. And I say to him, just listen to The Burning Platform and you won't get so cross.
Gareth, you should grab a soundbite of your father doing that and then play it as the intro for the show.
You have no idea. It's just absolutely... I mean, I was talking to my mother about this. She's about to lose her mind because she says he sits there and he gets his blood pressure up. And I mean, the guy is, you know, he's in his 60s. He's now worried about everything. He sees the news. It starts getting into a temper. It's just unbelievably bad for him.
Fully agreed. Yeah. Stay away from that poison.
Yeah, I'm going to get Jonathan Witt to come and talk to him as a medical professional. That's the only way he'll listen.
Right. Listen, he must stay away from those cigarettes. Eh?
Jesus, are you kidding? he's been smoking, and these illegal ones are so much worse for you.
Yep.
Oh, my God. Do you think I've spent all my life trying to convince him to stop smoking? He's never listened to me.
Yeah, well, some people can't be convinced, but hopefully legal cigarettes will be available soon, because believe it or not, the standards are much higher.
Yeah, there we go. Let's hope so. All right, everybody, thanks very much. That's The Burning Platform for this morning. CliffCentral.com. We will see you tomorrow at 6 o'clock. CliffCentral.com.